We are going to be looking at Acts 6 and part of chapter 7 tonight. It was a little bit tricky for me to decide how to do this because Acts 6 is abnormally short, but Acts 7 is abnormally long. And so I settled on splitting up Stephen's speech partway through as the least bad way of doing it. I mean, another alternative would have been to stretch chapter 6 into a whole class or try to cover 6 and 7 together and have to rush through Stephen's speech. Stephen's speech is the longest speech in the entire book, and it's a book full of speeches. He's also the first non-apostle believer to make a speech in the book. And it seems like Luke and the Holy Spirit must have had good reason to spend so much more time and detail on Stephen's indictment of the Jews than on, say, the first proclamation of the gospel or any number of other important moments throughout the book. Leaving off last time, the apostles had been beaten by the Jewish council. There was an escalation in the level of conflict there, but they remained totally unintimidated by this. Let's pick up in Acts chapter 6. Now at this time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on the part of the Hellenistic Jews against the native Hebrews, because their widows were being overlooked in the daily serving of food. So the 12 summoned the congregation of the disciples and said, "It is not desirable for us to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables. Therefore, brothers, select from among you 7 men of good reputation, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we may put in charge of this task. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." The statement found approval with the whole congregation, and they chose Stephen, a man full of trust and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch. And these they brought before the apostles, and after praying, they laid their hands on them. The word of God kept on spreading, and the number of the disciples continued to increase greatly in Jerusalem. And a great many of the priests were becoming obedient to the faith. We've seen before in chapter 2 and chapter 4 how the early believers took care of each other. Showed great generosity and sold spare properties. And now this problem arises in the distribution of these gifts. Some of the more Greek-influenced Jews, the Hellenized Jews, are getting overlooked. And the conflict specifically involves widows, who were a class of people that was especially vulnerable in the ancient world, and also a class of people that is repeatedly mentioned throughout the scriptures as being worthy of care and support. There's no indication there was any wrongdoing here, like, say, in the story of Ananias and Sapphira. This seems to just be a sincere oversight, and the apostles' response is that there should be some more organization to handle this. The apostles say, though, that they should not be the ones to deal with this matter, and instead they should appoint somebody else to do it. Personally want to do the appointing, they tell the congregation, "You guys pick out 7 guys to do this." And the qualifications are they have a good reputation and that they be full of the Spirit and full of wisdom. The emphasis on them being full of the Spirit is yet another reminder about how God's Spirit is being poured out on and dwelling in those who accept the message about Jesus, and the Spirit is active in the early church. In verse 4 and verse 6, we see prayer come up yet again in Luke's writings. It seems like at least once a chapter, he shows us somebody praying, whether he records the prayer or just mentions that they were praying. People are constantly devoting time to prayer in Luke and Acts. In certain segments of society today, it's become sort of fashionable of late to ridicule the idea that responding to problems with prayer is at all useful or worthwhile. And I find it interesting that the apostles' stance is that it's more important for them to pray than to deal with, deal personally at least, with this problem that has come up. It's not that they do nothing about it. They do want something done. But they certainly don't seem to think that them doing something is the highest priority over prayer. I did find a quote that I thought was really interesting and I think made an important point from this text that I wanted to read. "God calls all his people to ministry. He calls different people to different ministries. The expression full-time Christian ministry is not to be restricted to church work and missionary service. It can also be exercised in government, the media, the professions, business, industry, and the home. We need to recover this vision of the wide diversity of ministries to which God calls his people. And so the idea is that no one person can or should be doing all these things. The apostles couldn't wait tables and devote themselves to prayer and the ministry of the word. But all of those tasks are valuable, and they all require people who are full of the Spirit to do them. In the list of names in verse 5, Stephen is listed first and Philip is second. And although not much is made of them here in this specific story, they both go on to have important roles in the following stories, in the rest of chapter 6 and in chapter 7 and chapter 8, which again fits with the pattern we've seen of Luke introducing new characters in a kind of offhand, low-key way, and then bringing them back a little bit later as important figures in some sort of story. All the names are Greek in origin, which doesn't necessarily guarantee that they weren't from Palestine, but it does suggest that they may have come from among the diaspora Jews, the more Hellenized Jews. And the last guy isn't even a Jew, actually. He's a proselyte. The laying hands in verse 6 seems to be kind of a symbolic gesture, a way of the apostles endorsing this decision to entrust these men with their special responsibility. There's nothing in the context that suggests it has anything to do with the bestowing of miraculous gifts, like we'll see laying on of the hands sometimes used to mean. And the conclusion of the story is that this little conflict that came up, this disruption, does nothing to halt the growth of the church. All people, more and more people, are hearing the word and accepting it. And it's notable that it's making inroads even among the priests, which is sort of the people you'd expect to be most devoted to, you know, sticking with Judaism. But the gospel is even succeeding among the priests. Comments, thoughts about this section of the text? So the point was, it would then be that managing the finances is not nearly as important to us as prayer and the word. That seems very practical. Nathan?
Notice that also this wasn't something that was a new problem that arose. It was a problem that they were already aware of
Right.
And given later issues between the Jews and Gentiles within the church, you can't help but wonder if it's an omission of ignorance, or if they know good and well they're neglecting the Hellenistic widows, in which case you can see this being potentially a major problem very early on in the church, and they, obviously they solve it instead of it causing a rift of some kind, but not multiplying their ignorance.
Right. Guy? Yeah, there were ongoing issues.
It strikes me a lot of elderships, they're so into micromanaging. It's like they just, you know, they never delegate anything to anybody else. They just, you know, you wonder what the principle here would be, you know.
Right.
They have a better sense than that. We need to learn ourselves the ministry of the word and prayer.
There does seem to be a lesson there about priorities. Something else that struck me, if, you know, there's a valid comparison in the function these men are playing to the deacons that we read about in, what is it, Timothy and Titus, then, at least my recollection growing up was that I always had the impression that you could only have deacons if you had elders. But here, the apostles' stance is, it's not our job to pick these guys out. You guys pick them out, and then we'll endorse your decision. Which suggests that it's not something that the authority figures have to do. If there's a need and you need to, you know, to select specific people to handle the need, the group does that. Yeah.
Which indicates that the apostles thought that people could work it out best without giving them, at least there are no specific instructions that the apostles gave them for selecting.
For how to do it, yeah. Yeah, the people were responsible enough to work it out. Well, let's go on in chapter 6 then, picking up in verse 8. And Stephen, full of grace and power, was performing great wonders and signs among the people. But some men from what was called the synagogue of the freedmen, including both Cyrenians and Alexandrians, and some from Cilicia and Asia, rose up and argued with Stephen. But they were unable to cope with the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. Then they secretly induced men to say, "We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God." And they stirred up the people, the elders, and the scribes, and they came up to him and dragged him away and brought him before the council. They put forward false witnesses who said, "This man incessantly speaks against this holy place and the law. For we have heard him say that this Nazarene, Jesus, will destroy this place and alter the customs which Moses handed down to us." And fixing their gaze on him, all who were sitting in the council saw his face like the face of an angel. So this is the next step in the escalating conflict we've seen between the Jews and Jesus' followers. And it's going to set the stage for the spread of the gospel beyond Jerusalem. There's a focus in both of these stories on Jews seemingly from outside Palestine. In the first story, it's the Hellenized Jews, the widows that are being neglected. And then in this story, it's these Jews from these various places, Cyrene and Alexandria and Cilicia and so forth, that are arguing with Stephen and can't actually refute what he's saying. I thought it was interesting that we've seen Stephen described as full of trust and wisdom and the Spirit, and now he's also full of grace and full of power, which is quite impressive. Stephen is also the first person, besides Jesus and the apostles, who's mentioned as doing miracles, which is interesting to think about. In 9 and 10, you've got these seemingly, kind of non-local Jews arguing with Stephen. But he displays the traits that were mentioned when they were choosing the men for the seven, the wisdom and spirit. and it's on that basis that they can't refute or overturn what he's saying. And since they can't beat him logically, they decide to attack him personally. The mention of Cilicia in verse 9 might suggest that this would have been a place where Saul would have been, since that's where he was from. Doesn't guarantee it or anything, but it is interesting to note it's the same place. And if Jews from there were hanging out at this synagogue, then maybe Stephen and Saul would have encountered each other here. Another thing, this is one of the times where I wish Luke had explained more. He doesn't actually tell us what Stephen and these Jews were arguing about. The content of their debates or their arguments is not given. So I found that all the commentaries run rampant with speculation of all sorts over, well, maybe they were arguing about this, or I think they were arguing about that. And it's like, well, it doesn't say any of those things, which maybe tells us that what Stephen was disputing about is less important than the fact that he was full of wisdom in the Spirit and could not be overcome in debate. The charges, the false accusations and the false charges against Stephen are really interesting because they remind us of what shows up in the Gospels. In Mark and Matthew, we're told that at Jesus' trial before the Jewish council, the same group of people, they brought up false witnesses who claimed that Jesus said he would destroy the temple and then rebuild it. The actual statement that they're twisting of Jesus's comes from John 2, where he makes a similar but a little bit different comment, and he's really talking about his own body, not about the fancy building they had. None of these things appeared in Luke. They're not mentioned at all in Luke. But now in Acts, we see a false claim that Stephen is preaching this Jesus who said he would destroy the temple. So it's really fascinating how throughout all four of the Gospels, there's this kind of idea that fits together. But Matthew and Mark tell that this false accusation was made against Jesus, but don't explain what the basis was. And John tells the source of this false accusation, but never makes any use of it. And Luke has this follow-up to the story without having explained where it came from at all. Stephen's being tagged with the same false accusations that were used against Jesus, which, I don't know, maybe suggests that they're already out to kill Jesus kill Stephen like they were with Jesus. If they're bringing up the same false charges, do they have the same goal here? This event is also notable because it is the first time that ordinary people, just ordinary average Jews, are stirring up trouble and opposing the gospel rather than the Jewish leaders leading the opposition. It's the people that stir up the leaders to take action. There's also an irony here that Stephen is accused of speaking and acting against the temple and the law, and the guy who seems to be significant at his stoning, Saul, is later accused of acting against the temple and the law. So there's an interesting how that comes back around, I guess. And Stephen's face looking like an angel, whatever exactly that means, might call to mind how Moses' face was described as glowing after spending time around God's presence. And this might be especially appropriate considering that Stephen he stands accused of reviling Moses and the law. Comments, thoughts?
I just thought the accusation that they said this man, Jesus, will destroy this place. Either Jesus was dead, and the accusation is almost comical because he's going to do something, or they all believe Jesus did, in fact, arise from the dead, that he was living, and he was going to do these things. Uh-huh. So, if they've got any sense, then maybe there's
that's possible. It's also possible that just any kind of speaking against the temple, whether there was any basis for it or not, was just seen as such an offense against, the Jewish religion that it would have been, you got to stand up and oppose this. But I do think that's an interesting point. Well, what exactly did they think about Jesus if they're concerned that he's preaching that Jesus was going to do this? At least in their accusation. Adam? In Stephen's case, it seems to be precisely because he was so unstoppable in debate that they turned to false accusations and then killing him. I've never talked to anyone who wanted to kill me, so.
Yeah, but you do.
Well, that's true.
And the whole point is really plays into this accusation. He was saying something that was detrimental, at least to their understanding of the prestige and status of the temple and the law. There was a recognition in Stephen that with Christ, something greater than the temple and the law has come.
Yeah.
In some way, he is destined to replace that or surpass that or something.
Which does seem to be kind of an evolution of the gospel message that we've seen presented so far, a new dimension to it.
Right. No one like Peter would say, now, but at any cost, let's burn the temple down. Now.
Yeah.
Like that.
All right, well, let's continue on then, picking up at the beginning of chapter 7. The high priest said, "Are these things so?" And he said, "Hear me, brethren and fathers. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, 'Leave your country and your relatives and come into the land that I will show you.' Then he left the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. From there, after his father died, God had him move to this country in which you are now living. But he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot of ground. And yet, even when he had no child, he promised that he would give it to him as a possession and to his descendants after him. But God spoke to this effect, that his descendants would be aliens in a foreign land, and that they would be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. And whatever nation to which they will be in bondage, I myself will judge, said God. And after that they will come out and serve me in this place. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. So Abraham became the father of Isaac, and circumcised him on the eighth day, and Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. This is the third time so far in Acts where we've seen a believer on trial before the Jewish council, in these early chapters. And, of course, eventually we'll see Paul on trial before the council also. Stephen's asked about the false charges against him, and he doesn't directly answer the question, though he's not silent either, and he does, in a roundabout way, kind of deal with the question. He's accused of speaking against the temple and the law of Moses, and those are going to be major themes, as Tom mentioned, of his speech. In a way, you could say that this speech is the first time in Acts that we really see Christianity and Judaism starting to split. Whereas before, we've remarked previously that the disciples are still worshiping in the temple and doing all these things that normal, typical Jews would do, and not really seeing that in becoming followers of Jesus, they've somehow made a break with Judaism. But we're starting to see that take place. The speech recounts the history of the Israelites with a focus on four characters: Abraham, Joseph, Moses, and David. And he spends by far the most time with Moses, which, again, might make sense in light of the accusations against him. Tonight, we're just going to look at Abraham and Joseph here, but keep in mind that all of this is relevant next week also. Joseph and Moses stand out because they are leaders that God raised up that the Israelites rejected. Something else that I ran across a point in a commentary that I thought was really worth considering is that Stephen quite possibly didn't finish his argument. He may very well have had quite a bit more to say to develop, you know, where he was going with this or what point he was going to make, but he got interrupted and murdered instead. So that's something to consider as we read this, is that there may have been further connections he was intending to draw that he didn't get the chance to. Let's see. The idea of God appearing to Abraham all the way in Mesopotamia shows that God is bigger than the land of Canaan, and that Abraham's relationship with God long predated any connection to the land of Israel. And Stephen may be setting up the idea that God isn't tied to the temple to the extent that the Jews seem to think that he is. And his emphasis at this point is on the promises to Abraham. We also mentioned circumcision as part of the covenant. Abraham is the origin of the Jewish people, and the covenant of circumcision is the foundation of Israel's relationship with God. So there's a logic to beginning and showing that these things long predated the temple or the law of Moses. Thoughts about the first section of Stephen's speech? Guy?
I can't resist, from my background in communication, to analyze this sermon. It is obviously one of the different audiences we can face, a hostile audience. But notice how he begins. He first says, "Brethren and fathers," and then he says that the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham. And then numerous times he uses references to God, which should have at least settled down somewhat their hostility, because he doesn't begin by attacking them. He begins by establishing common ground, quotes from the scriptures, notes characters from their background that they would have acknowledged, which unfortunately doesn't end with a compliant audience. But when I look at sermons of the Book of Acts and other teachings, I believe that God is helping us to approach people who do not accept Jesus, but gives us means by which to do it. If we look at how Stephen and others and Paul and Peter have preached their sermons and mm-hmm. how we establish contact with people.
Yeah. Nathan? Yeah.
It kind of, you know, shows the lie of the whole kind of Christian, everything's going to work out great for you. I mean, one of the many ways that is shown to be false. Christianity is beginning. We're
And I don't know exactly when this takes place, but it can't be all that long after, you know, Pentecost. It hasn't been like years and years or anything. This is the same people. And so it shows that this conflict started ramping up fairly quickly. There was not this nice, long, peaceful period before trouble started. Other thoughts, ideas? Well, we might finish early then. But let's go on to the next section dealing with Joseph. The patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt. Yet God was with him and rescued him from all his afflictions and granted him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him governor over Egypt and all his household. Now a famine came over all Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction with it, and our fathers could find no food. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent our fathers there the first time. On the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and Joseph's family was disclosed to Pharaoh. Then Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all. And Jacob went down to Egypt, and there he and our fathers died. From there they were removed to Shechem and laid in the tomb which Abraham had purchased for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor in Shechem. One of the first things that jumps out is that there's lots of argument over this issue with the tombs, because in Genesis, Abraham buys a tomb near Hebron from a different group of people, not this. And there's various possible explanations for it, but it's something that people who want to attack the veracity of Acts will make a fuss about, apparently. Maybe something to be aware of in brief. Stephen pretty much skips over Isaac and Jacob. They aren't of as much interest to him in this story, and moves on to Joseph. And the jealousy that the Israelite forefathers show toward Joseph might call to mind the last time jealousy came up in Acts, which was back in chapter 5. At that point, the chief priests were jealous of the apostles. Despite the brothers' hostility, though, God gives Joseph favor and wisdom, which is a pairing that might remind us of something Luke has told us before. Back in Luke 2, he talked about how Jesus was growing in favor and wisdom, and also in stature. But it may be deliberate language, at least on Luke's part, that would set us up to be reminded of Jesus in the story of Joseph here. Despite the brothers' hostility, I already covered that, didn't I? And the other thing, Stephen fairly quickly summarizes the rest of the story of how, you know, the brothers came and the second time they found out who Joseph was and the whole family moved down to Egypt. It seems like his overall point in this section is to give an example of how God intended Joseph to save his family, but his brothers rejected him, and yet that did not stop God from fulfilling his plan. Thoughts about this? And in rejecting these chosen individuals like Joseph and Moses, they're not just rejecting these individual humans, they're rejecting God, since it was God's plan to use these people.
It does make you think that Stephen isn't done when they stone him. What the expectation is as this is coming to a close, you know, Joseph was rejected, but God used him. Moses was rejected, but God used him. Jesus was rejected, but Stephen does. What you expect is kind of like the end of the Acts 2 sermon. You know, this Jesus whom you crucified, God raised him day before the Christ.
Right.
Whatever exactly Stephen would have said, you expect him to kind of fill that out at the end, is that regardless of what you do, God is still sovereign. And that's what Joseph, of course, comes to realize as well at the end of the story. I mean, he says on a couple of occasions, you sold me here, but God sent me here.
Right.
He has been sovereign
we can't stand in God's way.
Right. We
not
try,
really.
But